Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Thank you to everyone who supports this show and all the shows in the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. If you're not already, you can become a Major Spoilers member by signing up at patreon.com/majorspoilers. And listen, we understand maybe you don't have a whole lot of money that you can contribute each month, but maybe you can be like Nicholas, who is our newest $1 patron. So we ended up with one new patron this week, and it's Nicholas, and all he's doing is a dollar a month. That's great. If we had 1,000 of you, 2,000 of you, 10,000 of you all doing a dollar a month, we would be sitting pretty, and we'd be able to do a lot more stuff and entertain you even more. So go find out how you can kick in your buck and have your voice read or your name be read here on the show, not that your voice be read. I don't even know how your voice would be read. But anyway, you could have that here on the show, patreon.com/majorspoilers.
Major Spoilers theme song!
The Major Spoilers podcast is on the air. On the air. The Major Spoilers podcast is on the air. On the air. Podcast.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven. If you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast,
The Major Spoilers podcast is on the air.
Oh, I think this is where I put in the music and it goes do 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 do. And then we get into our transition here where we say, welcome to the Major Spoilers podcast. We're doing the general topic. If you are a patron, we had a whole bunch of time that we spent talking about Shakespeare and scary movies. And I forget what else we talked about, strikes and a bunch of other stuff. You can find that at the Patreon pre-show episode that you can find at patreon.com/majorspoilers. So go and check that out. Everybody is here this week. Thanks to Nicholas, we're able to have all four panelists here at the same time. I wonder who is going to be... I am going to limit the amount of time that some people can talk because of the budget and how that runs, you know, how the internet runs.
I charge more for any words that I have to say that have the letter Z.
Oh, okay.
That's difficult. It's difficult for me to pronounce. So.
And Rodrigo and I both get a bug
who's
speaking a foreign language, correct?
Yes, yep. that is correct, Ashley.
Hey.
So I had a crazy dream.
Klingon count?
I had a crazy dream. And it was something really weird, but like all the Ted Lasso characters were there. And there was also the guy who plays Doc Ock and also the bad guy that tries to steal Indiana Jones's trip. Alfred Molina was also in there. He was kind of the heavy bad guy. And it was just like, you guys don't need to be, you shouldn't trust him. And so like the tall blonde woman from Ted Lasso, I forget what her name is.
The shame lady from Game of Thrones. Yeah.
Is that who that is?
I don't know her name, but that's the only thing I've seen. Yeah, she's shame. Oh, wow. Shame. Oh, wow. Shame nun.
Okay. So the shame nun.
I learned her name because she's actually fabulous. But
so the shame nun and Alfred Molina were talking about, working on a, like some kind of research paper together. And I was like, no, you need to stay away from Alfred Molina. He's the bad guy. He's really doing the bad stuff here in this storyline of whatever my dream was. And then the man who is the assistant on the show, the like the business side of the show, they're like, oh, he would be really great to write this paper about Shakespeare. And then he just kind of turns to the both of them and he says, or what if I write a paper on how really it was Black Widow who turned the United States against Captain America in that Iron Man movie?
Oh.
And that was really weird. So what do you think? Do you think that Black Widow in a what if universe, Black Widow would kind of turn on Steve Rogers, Captain America, to position him as an enemy of the state to advance her communist Soviet agenda? Would that make an interesting story or no in the what if universe?
In the what if, sure. I think you don't even have to look at fictional stories or Elseworlds or what ifs to have a Black Widow that's playing both sides, right?
Mm-hmm.
That there's a lot of comics and even some shows. I want to say that the Avengers show that came out after the Avengers, a cartoon show, spends
Earth's
a lot of
heroes.
Yeah, it spends some time kind of doing the is Black Widow actually bad stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It's just a really freaky dream that it was like, wow, you guys are mixing in all of my pop cultures into one crazy dream. Stop that. And then I woke up and had to go throw up.
Why did you have to go throw up?
So I made the mistake of saying, hey, I'm still young. I can eat whatever the heck I want. So
haven't I taught you anything?
I will go and I will eat some Taco Bell and I will have two chalupas and a regular soft taco. And then when I get home, oh, look, there's a whole container of little chocolate mini donuts that my wife had bought. I will eat four of those, not four containers, but four of those donuts. And then, oh, here's a Jolly Rancher. I remember Jolly Ranchers. I shall also eat a Jolly Rancher. And then I washed it all down with. Oh, and then my wife,
strawberry
No. Then for dinner, my wife made some au jus, you know, the roast beef with the au jus sauce. Mm-hmm. And of course, au jus sauce is French, I believe, Ashley, for just grease and fat.
It's literally with juice.
Yeah. And so just imagine all of that stuff sloshing around in your belly and you wake up at 2 a.m. and you're like, oh, something doesn't feel right.
Mm.
And so then it all came back up.
Yeah, I like how.
Oh! I forgot the coup de grace on this this day of never forget. Flaming Hot Cheetos.
Nice.
Oh, good Lord!
Yeah.
Why?
Now, of course, this is spread out over like an 8-hour period, but still.
Even said, respect my digestive tract. I think not.
I kind of felt like
beer and some Metamucil.
Yeah. Yeah. Ashley and Rodrigo probably won't get this unless they are fans of the Old Little Rascals. But there was a couple of times in the Old Little Rascals where they would go crazy and eat crazy stuff like that. And they'd end up at the doctor and the doctor would slide this X-ray machine in front of their stomach. And it would be like the hot dog and the cupcake are having a fight with one another.
They're completely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Completely whole.
Yeah. And so that was my waking up after my Captain America dream going, oh, this is not good.
Well, that's why you had the dream.
I don't think so, but maybe
upset your tummy. No,
literally,
you can't eat like you're 16 anymore.
The same thing happened to me
this weekend because I went out of town for a wedding. And so I had lunch at a restaurant and then I ate at the wedding, dinner at the wedding. So I would try, I was tired and I would try to go to sleep. And all that would happen is my stomach felt like a brick.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was really concerned about whether a new person in town was going to be upsetting to the avatar. Like, everybody was like, you better not let Cora see this guy. And I'm like, why does that matter? And they're like, you just don't let her see him. She's really upset at him. And I'd like wake up and I'd be like, that is weird. Okay, I'm just going to try to sleep again. And I would go back to sleep.
Right back,
and I would just
land
right back in that dream. And they'd be like, I think he's over there. And I think Cora's coming. And I'm like, Jesus, just calm down, everybody.
Yeah. Are you excited, Rodrigo, for the Legend of Cora RPG or no?
I'm interested.
Or I should say, not Legend of Cora, but it's because it's just Avatar RPG.
Yeah.
ATLA RPG.
Yeah, I'm interested in it, but it's a Powered by the Apocalypse game, I believe, which is fine. I don't have anything against it, but I always hope that if we got any sort of official Avatar RPG, it would be a little crunchier or a little more sort of like tactical combat-y or even abstract combat-y, because Powered by the Apocalypse just kind of cares about different things, right?
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see how they do it. But I'm not like chomping at the bit to see it.
Okay. I backed the Kickstarter to get the electronic version. I'm sure Brian did too. So, I'm sure one of us can share that with you. Cinema Joe's podcast says, if Ashley is on, Ashley's always on. There is no downtime for the Ashley. We'd love to know her feelings on the Titans' unconventional adaptation of Under the Red Hood and also the show's take on her beloved Tim Drake. It's not just hers.
He's been in like 2 minutes so far.
And what is your hot take on that?
I'm having a little bit of a hard time enjoying this season, knowing that the gentleman who, I'm not going to call him a gentleman, the absolute waste of human space who plays the Scarecrow assaulted people on set.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's really, and he's playing a bad guy and everything, but it kind of sucks to be like, oh, cool. So then you walked off and like rubbed yourself all over other. Okay, great. Super. Uh-huh. I think I come to a peace with Titans because I understand that it has nothing to do with anything else that happens to be branded Teen Titans. And because Brandon Thwaites is really good and, I can't pull the name of the kid who plays Jason Todd, but I really enjoy his take on Jason Todd. Mm. So, Under the Red Hood, I wish it didn't have to do with, I wish it was close. I wish it didn't have to do with Scarecrow because of the unfortunate implications of how that person behaved. I appreciate that they're trying to do something different. What I like about Titans is it really goes out of its way to be like, you are never seeing Batman. You are never seeing Superman. You are never seeing Wonder Woman. It's called Titan. It might as well just be called Dick and His Amazing Friends at this point. But like, what I like about like Ian Glenn playing Batman, for example, is, and he has some awesome scenes as Bruce. There's like some really good scenes with Bruce and Dick this season, but you are never, ever going to see that man in a bat suit. And I really appreciate that because that was a problem that like the Supergirl show had, was they kept having to like not put Superman in it.
Yeah.
So by making Batman a little older than we're used to seeing him cinematically, it just sort of per that type of media takes it off the table. So other than that, I have really been enjoying this season. And I think it's because it's very Bat family centric. Like they're hitting, it's basically like the Robins stories. It happens very quickly. They do Under the Red Hood in basically a half an episode.
Oh wow.
which is fine. Yeah, Jason's dead for like 80 whole set. Like I thought the Flash moved fast, but Titans has it outstripped by a country mile. The only thing they're dragging their heels on is Tim has been in maybe three whole scenes. So I don't think I can make like a fair judgment on Jay like her go in the role because he's really not got to do much. He has a great look. He delivered his 9 lines with aplomb. I like that he's Blasian. I think that that's a really cool thing. And I like that they didn't make him, because Tim is traditionally like a rich kid from Bruce's neighborhood. So I like that he's more working class. side of Gotham. I just think it makes them more relatable. And I'm hoping IMDb has now updated their episode listings for everybody except Raven, who's been in no episodes this season and is credited with being in all of them. So it looks like he's going to be in 3 episodes. So I can't wait for him to be in the penultimate episode wherein he says, maybe I ought to be Robin. And then the ultimate episode wherein he becomes Robin. Because that's, I'm assuming, how the pace of the show is going to work.
Yeah.
I don't really foresee a redemption for Jason this season. But they fully brutally murdered one of the Titans. So, I mean, who knows? Anything is possible.
Wow. Maybe I should tune into this show. You know, you said that they had to dance around. Sure. They had to dance around the whole Supergirl, Superman thing. In the first season
of Supergirl, they have to handicap him so bad.
He's lying
on a table on his belt.
Right, with it's just his boots, right? But on the other hand, when they finally said, yeah, let's just go ahead and do it. We can't dance around this anymore. We got a great Superman out of that. So maybe if they did the same thing here, we'd end up with this guy who plays Bruce Wayne. Would he be a good Batman?
He's a 65-year-old Scottish man.
He's your hot English professor. Like, I would love to see it. I thought he was a hottie in Game of Thrones, but I don't see Titans doing that.
I want to see Batman in a kilt.
I literally don't think Titans is progressive enough to be like, yeah, put him in a bat suit. Who cares? This is fantasy.
A bat kilt. Yeah. A bat kilt. That's what I want to see. Carl writes in and says, questions for the next Major Spoilers podcast. I recently attended a panel discussion from a virtual comics and zines festival. The topic was abstraction in comics, and the panelists showed some fascinating examples. So I have 2 questions. First question, what is your favorite comic or graphic work that uses abstract imagery, not necessarily throughout, but as an important element? I really don't know, because I would have to see what some of these panelists were showing to see that. I think there have been some, and I can't name specific comics, but I know that there are comics that use collage as a means of
a lot of collage in Fantastic Four around 67, 68.
Yeah. So I think that the use of collage is really interesting in comics, but I don't know if that's abstract enough.
I think the easy, like mainstream answer is Morrison's Arkham Asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good one. I would say Big Numbers, which sadly will probably never ever be finished, but it was from like 89. It was Alan Moore at the peak of his fame and Bill Sienkiewicz, and the 2 issues that got actually printed were just Sienkiewicz going nuts. And if you're familiar with Bill's 80s style, it's already very abstract, it's very angular and impressionistic. But Big Numbers was essentially Alan Moore trying to make a story out of the Mandelbrot set.
Oh, okay.
And Bill Sienkiewicz basically trying to actually wildly succeeding in taking this concept of weird mathematical symmetry and putting it into a story that's actually relatively mundane. It was supposed to go 12 issues. The first one came out, then the second one came out like a year later. And then I think the company went under, and by the time they got back to it, Sienkiewicz couldn't do it. So his sidekick was going to do it, but then the sidekick had some sort of emotional breakdown and destroyed an entire drawn issue. I shouldn't say sidekick. His artistic partner or protege, a guy named Columbia, if I can remember correctly, had a friend named Magenta. They drew comics.
Rodrigo, do you have an example?
I don't know about a favorite, but I think a good place to look for abstraction in comics was that late 80s, early 90s kind of Vertigo stuff. I think, you know, Swamp Thing's got some, Sandman's got some. There's just stories within those things that lend themselves to it, and there will be, you know, panels and panels where, like, you're not actually looking at anything concrete,
right?
You're just, you know, in dreams or looking at, you know, swamps or dreamscapes or whatever.
That issue long sex sequence between Swamp Thing and Abby where everything has to be abstract.
So back in those days, they were really letting those guys do whatever they wanted, and And that's what people kind of wanted in their comics. You know, we read, what was that thing where like Batman gets drugged?
The one where he gets with the preacher guy and the zombies in the sewers.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Batman, so that one has
the cult. Yeah.
I don't know if it can, I don't know how much like full on abstract stuff it has, but yeah, it definitely has a lot of art that is more evocative of what Batman is feeling rather than here is a guy and here is another guy. Right.
Yeah. We're all dead down here. Carl's second question. It's common to make distinctions between high culture and low culture, or between fine art and illustration or graphic design. Do you think that those are valid? Question. So really he has three questions here. So
valid.
I think it's valid.
I think that it's valid, but it's also archaic.
It kind of falls into like, I think it comes across as somewhat elitist, but at least when you couch something in a high culture or low culture, it kind of defines what your expectations are. So if you're using it to help define what an expectations are, just like we say a genre, right? So if we say action or Western or, mystery, we know what to expect when we go into that stuff. So I think when you use high culture, low culture, or fine art and graphic design, I think those are valid in helping you determine what your expectations are when you go into it. I don't think it's valid to say that comic books are low culture and Rembrandt paintings are high culture.
But comic books have always been low culture. I mean, they're literally disposable.
But to use it, but in that case, then it becomes a derogatory term, right?
Right. And I think that's part of it. I mean, if you look at things from when we were kids, reading comic books was, for instance, one of the reasons that we were shown that Gilligan, for instance, was childlike and not as intelligent as the other characters on the island. I mean, when you look at least for me, modern culture and the way things have been, you know, things have all become, you know, it's about IP now. It's about mashups. It's about recognizable properties. I feel like the actual lines, the conceptual barriers that used to be between the high culture of Mrs. Howell and the low culture of Gilligan aren't really there anymore. And the divisions are really more symbolic. They're more for a point.
But
they're
not necessarily
about aesthetic choices. They're about, you know, I don't like capes and tights. I feel like that's saying, you know, that is saying I don't like everything being this, but it can also be taken as saying, That's played out. That's tired.
Yeah.
That's childish.
Well, that's,
you know, it's low culture.
And I look at it from the standpoint of at least you go into what to expect. So if someone said, oh, this is some really highbrow humor or this is lowbrow humor, you know that in the highbrow, you will have some, you know, comment along and then some gas passed out of his buttocks. And then on the low culture, it'll be like, yeah, he ripped a big old fart. And, you know, and you can kind of you use that as kind of a delineation to kind of know what you're expecting to go in there. But
sure.
So I think from that point, it's valid, but I also think that unfortunately it gets used in a derogatory way. Rodrigo, do you want to weigh in?
Sure. It's interesting that you touched on it being derogatory because I don't think there's a way that it ever isn't derogatory. It's real interesting because I think that most of the time high culture and low culture is mostly used to differentiate basically rich people and poor people and the things that rich people like and the things that poor people like. But in the United States, everybody fancies themselves like a underdog scrapper. Like you look at like their most like the richest people that live in the United States, they all think of themselves as underdog scrappers, right? It's like even though they have billions of dollars. So high culture and low culture is like inscrutable in the US because the majority of people say they want low culture. So low culture is like has become huge. That's where comic book movies come from, right? That's where
reality TV
comes from. Like all this stuff that's very popular, you know, like
it's for the masses.
It's all for the masses. And that makes high culture just like this small like sliver of like people that like maybe tune into like Will Schwartz's stuff on NPR where he talks about doing the New York Times crossword or whatever. And
they use Yearly for the vowels.
Yeah. You know, it just kind of leaves this like these like high culture slivers around that some people are into, but chances are those same people are into a lot of quote unquote low culture stuff, because that's like by far that's what I think what is dominant in the United States. Mm-hmm. There was a time when you had the upper crust and the lower crust and they watched and experienced different things, but now the majority of people enjoy what really used to be lowbrow stuff, but the term is almost useless now.
Yeah.
Except, you know, it's going baked into it to have elitism as part of, I mean, when you look at it, it's almost, you know, a breakdown from aristocratic culture. You know, the idea that there's the intelligentsia, there's the smart people, there's the higher people. And, you know, specifically American culture, but a lot of Western culture is against that notion of an aristocracy. You know, if you look at something like Keeping Up with the Kardashians, that is a universal punchline. And yet somehow it was one of the most popular things on basic cable week after week after week. People, you say, oh, well, they're overexposed and all of this blah, 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 but millions of people are still watching it.
I mean, it's Keeping Up with the Kardashians is a magnificent example of this thing that is considered very lowbrow, and yet we are tuning into the thing that is the closest America has to an aristocracy, right? Mm-hmm. Like to like very wealthy, like just born wealthy people, just kind of going about their very expensive days.
Yeah.
Then, of course, you can bring this back around to our pre-show. There's also Shakespeare, which did cross the line. Ashley, you've been studying some German. There's, you know, there's also this idea of the High Deutsch and the Low Deutsch, at least whenever I was learning German in college, that the High Deutsch was the more proper formal way of speaking German. And then there was the lower way
of speaking. Your Z's and your.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's, and then you have the lower Deutsch or the lower German, which was more slang terms and that kind of stuff that was brought in. So while there, at least in my opinion at the time, there was not a, you know, turning someone's nose down at someone that spoke the low German, in order to understand German, you have to learn the proper way to get into that. You want to weigh in on this? Because Carl's second part of his question is, if so, do you think that there are comics that cross the line from low to high, and what about them makes them different? You want to weigh in on that, Ashley?
Oh, I hate the demarcation between high and low art. Like, is it art or is it not? Some of the most beautiful art that I found is made by, oh my gosh, I can't come up with a word, but it's like, it's a very derogatory word for people who use like found objects. You know, they're not formally trained.
Oh, sure.
And, God, I can't think of what, there's like a whole King of the Hill episode making fun of it. And there's a Simpsons episode making fun of it where it's like, look at these idiots with their pop can art. But
Dada,
you can,
stuff.
No, okay. I'm gonna have to Google it, but, I don't like that distinction that just because you got a grant,
right,
or some institution slapped an award on you, that what you're doing is more worthwhile than anything else. It's also why I do not like the branding in the modern world, particularly in new media, which isn't that freaking new anymore. Of content creator, like, no, it's not like, cause to me, content is like, it's disposable.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 And that's,
you know, it's like, that's not what I view what I do. And so I don't like that label. So like, if it's art and it is made with the intention of expressing something, it's art, period. I don't care where it is, what the medium is.
Art is art.
If it makes you feel something, it's worthwhile. But, and sometimes that is in the Louvre, and sometimes that is painted on a wall in South Central. And I think both are equally valid and equally important. Now I'm going to get off my soapbox.
Sure.
And
Google
this
is it mom and pop art? Is it Mom and Pop, no, Pop Art? Because that was the 13th episode of the 10th season.
Art. It's called Outsider Art.
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like they make it seem like some hillbilly came down from the Appalachians with a glass on a stick, and it's so artistic because he's so innocent that he couldn't possibly put any thought in it. It just happened to be beautiful. Like, so angry.
I watched another one of those video essays on YouTube where someone was, maybe being a little bit too much crawl up his own butt kind of thoughts, but he was defending Martin Scorsese's semi-attack on Marvel movies as, not movies, not cinema.
Like Spielberg talking about Netflix and then taking a huge deal with Apple TV. Like, you're old, I get it.
Right, no, and it's not necessarily about change, but it kind of goes into this idea of this elitism of culture that, if you're a cinemaphile, then you look at movies as this art, this high thing that you want to attain, as opposed to, from what Scorsese's essay was apparently trying to say, that movies have just become this disposable wasteland of anything goes just to amuse the masses. And, I think that you can have art that is both of those things and can cross all of those lines. I think, as I said, it's derogatory, but I really think that if you were to say if you think about it in film genre, I think that helps you understand what you're going in and what you're expecting. Ashley and I used the term earlier, A24 film. Well, but for our language, we know what to expect when we say an A24 film. One of the things that essay goes into that I wanted to bring back around was, are you a content creator or are you an artist? And this guy was like, well, if you're making true cinema, then you are an artist. And if you're not, if you're just doing stuff for Netflix, then you're just a content creator.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And it's pretty useless, right? It's a useless distinction. And it becomes more useless as we move forward and as more and more stuff comes out for streaming. You can have more useful classifications, like an A24 film is much more useful than high art and low art, right? An educational piece is much more, is there an educational component to this that is much more relevant than, whether this was a video essay on YouTube and therefore, I guess, low art.
That's kind of the irony there, right?
It's a documentary actually shot on like actual cellulose and thus high art.
Matthew, didn't you and I have this discussion last week on Dueling Review pre-show or post-show about Christopher Nolan and how he only believes that stuff that's a movie should be shot on film and you should only see movies in the movie theater and you're wasting your time and you are a heathen if you watch it on television or on an iPad. I think we had that conversation last week.
We did. And, we touched on it then and Rodrigo touched on it again here. There's an inherent element of classism and in some ways nationalism kind of built into this discussion because, we talk about Shakespeare was disposable pop culture crap in the 15th, 16th, 17th century, whenever it was. I'm not good with numbers. And, there was a time when going to see a play in the round by Shakespeare was something that was for the lower class people, the agrarian people. And if you look at kind of a counterculture example, when I think about the argument of high and low culture, specifically as it relates to comic books, I think about an important thing that we sometimes forget about the early days of comic books. And that is the fact that Stan Lee was born Stanley Lieber and Max Gaines was born Maxwell Ginsburg and Jack Kirby was Jacob Kurtzberg. And a lot of these people were in the comic industry building everything that we know in comic books from the ground up, partly because of the disproportional influence of Jewish creators who couldn't get jobs in the quote unquote real arts. So when you look at a guy like Jack Kirby, who Jack Kirby changed his name, first of all, so that people would not go, hey, we can't hire this Jewish guy.
Well, he also changed it because he was embarrassed to write comics and he wanted to save Stanley Lieber for his quote unquote real writing.
Right, but that's, I mean, that's the thing that you look at. Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, very similar story. These are, you know, young creators, but they are all young creators who are Jewish. And as they started building these tropes of comics, you see that in play. You see how that shapes those early notations of what comics are. And if you look at, you know, like early Superman's class warfare against the evil landlords and the bad people and the racists and the jerks, you know, Superman versus the Klan was one of our recent things. And that's something else that comes into play. It's when I talk about low culture, a lot of times it feels like we're just talking about a countercultural element, something that isn't in the upper class, for intentional reasons by the members of that upper class. And they're considered a bad influence or a subpar creator because of factors that they can't control. So I don't feel like comics do cross the line from low to high, to address Carl's question, simply because at that point, I feel like I'm validating a system that is, as I've said, archaic, no longer meaningful, and in a lot of ways, damaging both to the art and to the psychological, you know, wellness of the people reading the books and watching the movies and watching the TV shows. So, you know, at that said, I think there are comic books that are absolutely high art, but I'll, you know, that I think is a separate argument. They're still, you know, most of the time, stapled paper pamphlets that cost, you know, a couple of bucks.
We hope you've enjoyed our conversation this week on NPR's comic book discussion forums. If you enjoy these kinds of conversations and deep thoughts, don't worry. We have even more deep thoughts coming your way this week, thanks to all of our fine, fine fans over in our Discord server who took the time to craft very well thought out questions for this week's show, such as this one from Jarmo, who says, "What, in your opinion, are the main reasons live-action adaptations from animated properties, usually from Japan, but also older Western-made, fail to reach the popularity and acclaim of the original?" Ashley Victoria Robinson, we're going to turn to you.
I'm trying to decide, because there's only two female voices on NPR, if I'm going to go for the soprano or if I'm going to go for the alto options.
Go for the alto. I want to hear it.
Oh, don't worry. We can go the other end on this show as well, because these crazy knuckleheads over in Discord decided to get into a whole thing of how the word color is supposed to be spelled with a U or without a U. And they started asking a bunch of silly questions that involved favorite vowels and whatnot. So we also didn't forget about those people as well.
Color.
So
just like it looks, color.
You have too much time on your hands. Favorite, I know, right? Vowel.
Is it the inability to understand what made a good story from the get-go, cultural detachment of the subject matter, the way and how they are produced, lack of vision, or is it just they already peaked and there's no mainstream audience to be found?
I have two very strong beliefs about anime to live action adaptation specifically.
Okay, let's tackle that one, since Cowboy Bebop is on everybody's lips right now,
which I'm not excited for. But much like Godzilla, I don't think American studios should make live action adaptations of anime, because it is something that I think is quintessentially Japanese, and I don't think we get it. And I think that's why the best live action manga adaptation is Pretty Guardian Sailor Moon, which was made in Japan with a Japanese cast. And almost none of the live action American studios are successful or critically successful. And I lump in the Godzilla movies with that, because Shin Godzilla is the best modern Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
And it's so good.
I think. Yeah, go ahead.
I also think, and this is something that I've seen pointed out by a lot of other people, a big thing about making anime, right, is the economy of panels and where you choose to spend your money. And that is what gives anime its distinctive style and the mood. And when you think of something like My Hero Academia, where even if it's the UA Sports Festival, if it's Todoroki and Midoriya and they are facing down, there will be 15 whole seconds of a still panel of each of them as the camera, quote unquote, moves around them. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the mood, and that's part of the style. And then that counterpoints all the lines that are going to come up later on when Midoriya finally uses his powers and like breaks his whole art. Like, and I don't think you can capture that in live action in the same way. I think there are some movies that get pretty close. I think actually Shang-Chi steals a lot, apes a lot of that style, as much as it's also borrowing from the Hong Kong style. But I also think it's a difference in the mediums.
I think one of the main reasons why live action adaptations are made from this is because, just like with superhero movies back in the 80s and the 90s, anime is being looked at by a large portion of the population as, I don't want to watch them cartoons where they don't even speak English. I don't even know what's going on. Right. So there's that part of the audience. Very much like if you were then to take that and turn it into a live adaptation, they'll be like, oh, this is the greatest thing in the world. And then you say, well, this is based on an anime called Cowboy Bebop. They're like, huh, how about that? Very much like they're like, I sure do like that gangster film. And you're like, yeah, Road to Perdition, that's based on a comic book. And they also deride, you know, comic books in that same sentence. Right. So I think that, and I'm not saying that that's the right way to approach it, but I think that the execs look at this and say, nobody takes, just like comic books, like we were talking about a minute ago, nobody takes the anime seriously. And so therefore we have to do a live action adaptation in order to attract that other portion of the Venn diagram to the movie theater. And I think that's the main reason.
For me, I feel like adaptations are always difficult because when something is created, be it created as a comic or a cartoon or a stop motion, you know, rubber chicken thing like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, it's created in a particular medium. It's created with specific tools. And when you translate it to a different medium, you have different tools. And you can't take your hammer and, you know, drive screws into the wood of a live action movie the way you would, you know, if you were just hammering nails into a cartoon. And that is an awesome metaphor. You need to write that down, kids. But when you take, like, for instance, one of the listed ones that I've seen both versions of, the Last Airbender movie is bad because it takes all the things that made Avatar The Last Airbender, the cartoon, unique, and says these are weird edges that need to be sanded down to make this a more palatable blockbuster movie. And that's what you have to do for an adaptation.
Yeah, the weirdest thing about The Last Airbender is that Shyamalan went into that just saying, my kids are into this. I'm not really sure what it's about, but I'm going to adapt it without really understanding it.
Exactly. He didn't even have an appreciation of it. And I feel like that's part of it. You know, when you look at things like when I was growing up, we had G-Force, and it's not the same as an adaptation, but it is a regionalization of a Japanese cartoon that was bloody and weird and sexy and bizarre and had a main character who was gender fluid and would change from being a man to being a woman. And then you would bring it over to America and they'd be like, oh yes, this is his little sister, teehee. You have those moments where, you know, oh yes, that's her cousin. Why are they kissing? Oh, they're very close. You know, you have those moments of when you're adapting something, you have to take into account what it used to be. And sometimes what it used to be is specific to cartoons or comic books. And what it used to be, you put it on film, and it just, you could do a perfect shot for shot adaptation of something. And you know what you'd walk away with? Frank Miller's The Spirit. And that's a god awful movie. You should never watch it. You should never let your friends watch it. You should tell everyone you know to not watch it.
Wrong, sir. But Rodrigo Lopez, please share your ideas.
Shut up. Petty, petty, buke, buke. So,
Tony.
It's interesting that comic book or superhero movies got brought up because you, a question you could ask to sort of put this in perspective is, why are comic book superhero movies successful now where they weren't before? And a big part of that reason is an accepted language, right? It used to be that anytime anybody translated superheroes to the big screen, they would have to create language, like create visual language around that to justify, to smooth out, to bring these things to life. And people would watch that and be like, no, that's not right, right? Examples of this, Steel, right? That whole movie. We talk about the Ang Lee Hulk where there's like flying comic book panels, right? It's like, is it the panels that make superheroes interesting? Asks Ang Lee. And the answer is no, it's not.
You're doing it wrong.
Yeah. So then we get to, I would say, two movies that brought us here are definitely Blade and its sequels and The Matrix, showing us kind of how to do big special effects kinetic action, right? Blade essentially writing down the Bible of how you do a superhero adaptation, and The Matrix giving us all of those special effects tricks to make somebody hanging from a wire actually look kinetic, right? And again, Hong Kong was doing this a thousand years ago, but you need to translate that, not from Chinese to English, but from Hong Kong media to American media, right? Now that all that stuff is translated, you can just pop out a superhero movie like Marvel has been doing, and you don't have to worry about that stuff anymore. We already know what superheroes look like, what they're capable of, how they move, how a superhero movie should move, etc. So obviously anime is not a genre, but a huge collection of genres, but it has language in common, visual language in common. The day somebody finally cracks it and manages to make either a decent bubblegum crisis or a decent Your Lie in April movie or whatever, the floodgates will open and people will start accepting anime movies in that sense, or at least particular wedges or genres of anime stuff.
Mm-hmm. J. Michael T. says, the Unspooled podcast discussed this briefly, but I thought it was an interesting question. Which is more influential to pop culture, Roadrunner or Mickey Mouse?
Depends on what you mean by influential.
Well, influential to pop culture. My answer would definitely be Mickey Mouse. And when you say influential, I think you have to look at the overall history. Now, J. Michael T. says his opinion, Roadrunner, because the characters had personalities and were involved in scenarios that have influenced pop culture across movies, TV shows, whereas Mickey Mouse has been diluted to a global property that mostly exists to represent the Disney Corporation and has to be bland and risk averse. I would say it's just the opposite of that, right? Mickey Mouse came out long before Roadrunner and really kind of reshaped animation and pop culture ever since then. You know, without Mickey Mouse, you wouldn't have the Looney Tunes. Without Mickey Mouse, you wouldn't have had Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Without Mickey Mouse, you wouldn't have theme parks and live action motion pictures. You wouldn't have built an empire that literally owns everything that you love. Marvel, Disney, Star Wars, all of these kinds of things. Yeah, The Simpsons, Alien, Buffy now. So when you look at it, I think Mickey Mouse is more influential because of what it has led to. And even though Disney may be a huge media conglomerate that owns everything, we wouldn't have the Shang-Chi movie if it wasn't for Mickey Mouse at this point. So I'm gonna argue Mickey Mouse. Anybody else agree, disagree?
I believe visually. In terms of what cartoons look like now, what cartoons looked like in 1933, and what cartoons look like in 1950s, I'm going to say Roadrunner has a bigger influence on animation as it exists today, simply because Chuck Jones was rewriting the rules, you know, the Bob Clampett school, the old school.
Sure.
Everything is, you know, a gag. Chuck did a lot of things that, you know, in 1953, 1958, they were like, what are you doing? You can't do that. You can't do the squash and stretch like that. You can't do these smear effects. you can't do these wild, you know, explosion moments, or you're breaking the rules when you stay on that long overhead shot and just let the coyote fall and be tiny, and then you hear the far away. All of those things have influenced the visual lexicon of animation in ways that I don't necessarily feel that Walt Disney's work, or, you know, any of those dudes' work on those Disney cartoons does, because those cartoons are now antiques. And when you look at modern Disney works, when you look at the stuff that's coming out of Disney cartoon studios these days, they're very much influenced by the Looney Tunes of the 50s and 60s. And, you know, all of the modern Looney Tunes is just basically built on McKimson and Chuck Jones and a couple of other guys in there. But I understand Steven's point. I would also point out that, you know, Steven loves Disney a lot.
Yeah, but I also realize that Disney is very problematic. Also, again, we're talking all of pop culture, not just animation, right? So when we talk about all of pop culture,
well, then are we talking about the characters, or are we talking about the corporations?
Yeah, see, that's where it gets into it, because I mean, I have a strong thought that if you went to any country in the world and you showed them a picture of Mickey Mouse, most people around the world would instantly recognize Mickey Mouse. I'm not sure most people around the world would instantly recognize the Roadrunner.
It depends on how you define influence, too. So yeah.
So I think, unfortunately, it is Mickey Mouse, right? And it's for a meta reason. Mickey Mouse is the most influential because it continues to warp copyright law in the United States.
He's the reason why copyright law has been changed, in fact.
Yep.
The Roadrunner benefits from that, or rather Warner Brothers benefits from that in maintaining control of the Roadrunner. But yeah, unfortunately, the most influential cartoon character is Mickey Mouse, and the Disney Corporation will basically form into a giant Voltron and eat the Supreme Court before they let that animal go.
And Mickey will form the head. Ashley, thoughts? Yep.
It's really tough because I fear the answer is Mickey Mouse, even though Mickey Mouse as a character himself has done nothing of note for,
you need to watch the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse. Yeah, that's where the real Mickey action is.
Or the shorts. I don't know if you guys have seen the new shorts.
Yeah, I hate the animation.
I like those.
Good, you should. I mean, it's something different.
Yeah.
I recently learned that Mickey Mouse's whole color palette / makeup I don't want to say an problematic homage, but that it,
thing.
Yeah, and that, like, that's really hard for me. I don't have any Mickey Mouse iconography in my home, but if I did, it would be really tough for me. So I don't want something as impactful and as important as it is that ties into something so ugly to be as influential as it is. And someone somewhere is screaming that I'm naive to think it's the only one. And I am by no means am saying that. I don't think Warner Brothers Animation has done the same thing.
There's Bosco. Still
Tom and Jerry characters with the mammies. It's not great either, but that's not who the Roadrunner is, but I don't know. It's tough. I think this is a hard conversation to parse because we're getting lost in the corporate power of Disney. Mm-hmm. Even though arguably Disney certly in the last 20 years has benefited more from properties they've bought than anything original.
But it's only because
this is somebody
of
literally sitting in a Haunted Mansion shirt right now. So yeah. I understand the hypocrisy.
No, but also to understand that in order for Disney to be able to buy those properties and to keep those properties going, Mickey Mouse, you know, it's called, you know, it's the House of Mouse. It built the fortune that allowed all of these things to continue. So it is very problematic. J. Michael T. also asks, was the movie Dune worth remaking? I haven't seen it, so I can't tell you, but I do know that the first one was kind of wackadoo. So I'll be interested to see what they do with it.
The story of Dune, I think, is worth remaking, but I also think it's impossible to turn into one coherent movie. I mean, you're talking about what, like 7-8 books in a shared universe?
Rodrigo?
I understand that Dune is a very, even just the first book is very dense. So, you know, I think that people looked at the fact that the Lord of the Rings was going to be a thing that, you know, they were adapting the first book and eventually all three. And they were like, there is no way. There is too much garbage. And they're not going to know when they're adapting and cutting what's the garbage and what's the absolutely perfect stuff that you need to keep. And really, from reception, I think that Peter Jackson nailed it, right? So you have to assume that it's possible. It just takes somebody who both understands the text and knows what the chaff is, you know, when it comes to an adaptation, even though it might be.
Tom Bombadil.
That is absolutely, absolutely it, right? People love Tom Bombadil and they cut it out of the movie and people are like, oh, they cut out Tom Bombadil. Oh, well, I'm going to watch this extended edition of The Lord of the Rings again, you know.
Oh, Ashley's like, being called out.
A rubbish character.
Yeah, nobody didn't watch The Lord of the Rings because they were mad about Tom Bombadil, right? So,
yeah. Ashley, thoughts on Dune without going into your love for Tom Bombadil?
The best part about the Tom Bombadil scene is that all the hobbits lay naked together in the grass, and I think that's very funny every time. I couldn't go see the screening I got invited to for Dune, which makes me sad. So I'm going to have to see it on my home screen like everyone else. I don't know, because there's a lot of big stories like that, right? Like, I kind of think you can't tell a King Arthur story on film unless it is something as specific as the Green Knight. And certainly giving him lightsabers is a choice. And I wonder, having only finished reading Dune last year, I wonder if it is too much and too complicated, but I'm excited to see them try, because even that made for TV movie where James McAvoy turned into a bunch of worms was like not entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, there you go. All right. I don't understand this question. What happened to Mark Waid? He's working over at Marvel. He's doing some stuff for DC.
He's doing just fine.
Yeah. He's also got a
winning award.
Yeah. He's also got a class that you can take from him on writing comics. He does it only like once every 3 months or something like that. But he'll pop up
through Comics Portal.
I believe so. I haven't taken, I'd be very interested in it, but my understanding, it's a live event and I can't make the live events. So there you go. Let's see. These are really great questions, you guys. Lagnus says we've only got time for like one or two more. I would love to continue this and do a whole bunch of shows like this, especially when you guys write in some really great questions. I think it's provoked a lot of great thought, a lot of great discussion this week on the show. So thank you everybody for that. If you haven't, get over onto the Major Spoilers Discord. There's a link in the show notes because that's where everybody's posting their questions and just interacting with one another. If you were interested in what I was talking about earlier with Matthew and I talking about Christopher Nolan and the Dueling Review pre-show, we record the Dueling Review podcast live at 8 o'clock p.m. Central Time. And so about 7:30, 7:40 or whenever we both get in there, we usually talk for about 15 or 20 minutes with everybody that's live in the chat with us. And then usually another 5 or 10 minutes after the show is done recording. So if you want to hear more of that, definitely hook up to the Major Spoilers Discord server. It would be great if I could make a Patreon goal where we did something like this more often and separate from the Major Spoilers podcast. But I think we need some more patrons for that. So you can find out more on how you can become a patron if you're not already at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Question from Lagnus. Maybe this is the one that we're going to go out on. Are there no horse comics in the U.S.? Has there ever been? Here, that's a pretty big market. So just curious. Well, nobody can draw horses, so that's why we don't have any horse comics in the U.S.
Not in years. Horse comics kind of went away when Western comics did. But if you go back to about the period from about 1948, when superheroes were on the wane, to about 1954 or 55, when the superheroes came back, there are a lot of Western comics, and I know specifically Silver, the Lone Ranger's horse, and Roy Rogers' horse Trigger had their own books. There was a long-running Black Fury comic from Charlton, which was a knockoff of Black Beauty. But yeah, horse comics really aren't a thing in modern American comic books, unless you're counting Dark Horse, which And that's a different thing.
By horse comics, that means comics where the main protagonist is a horse or that feature horses prominently.
That's what I'm guessing. I mean, we haven't seen Comet around in a long time. That's my guess, is that it has to do with horses as the main character.
I guess we're not counting My Little Pony.
Aha! Good one, Ashley. Those Victoria Robinson for the win.
Thank you.
Ashley, where can people find more of you?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram, and you can tweet me your hot takes on Titans. I'd love to talk to people about that. The last time I tweeted about it, people got really angry with me at Ashley B. Robinson. The B is very important. Also, I'm doing a bunch of shows in LA. My Halloween show got extended for one more weekend, so come and see me.
How has that been? I noticed that the theater is covered in plastic. Is that because there's lots of blood spilled during the show, or is that a COVID thing?
That's a COVID thing for rehearsals.
Oh, okay. All right. I was just curious.
They're not hanging, but people are required to wear masks.
Okay. Very cool. All right. So go check those shows out that Ashley's in. I'm sure she will be in a lot more in the near future. Matthew, where can people find more of you?
You can find me basically hanging around Ashley's Instagram. It's fascinating and awesome. I don't really say anything there. And on the Twitter at Mighty King Cobra, where I spend my lunch hour every day espousing about nonsense superheroes of the past, future, and the past of the future. So you can do that. That's fun.
Rodrigo, what about you?
You can find me at Fearsome Critter on Twitter. That's pretty much the main gateway to the stuff I'm doing. Obviously, all the podcasts that I'm on for Major Spoilers, which is like another couple ones.
Yep. And of course, you can find me at Major Spoilers, and everything at Major Spoilers can be found at majorspoilers.com. You know what? I have been, and I found out that this is something that has lessened a lot of my stress recently, is I'm spending less and less time with my eyeballs glued to the Twitter feed. But do reach out. I will respond to you if you reach out to me. But you may notice that I'm not posting a lot of here's my hot take on this thing as much anymore, because I just don't think that it's number one, interesting for you. And number two, it's not healthy for the rest of us. So if you don't see me just quoting crazy things on the Internet, on Twitter, you can still reach out to me. I'm still there. Don't worry. At Major Spoilers. And that's where we will be. And we will be back next week on the Major Spoilers podcast. Why? Because we know that you love comics, and we do too, and we will talk with you soon.
If I had the X-ray vision of Superman, I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose, I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic bookstore guy knew, he kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Wait, think about a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Start raving rich like a man of iron. Might not be surprised to find that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. But would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun, being in the Middle East with a gang sign throwing soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler, whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
This podcast is copyright 2021 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop.
Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
So, you've got an idea for a business. The store of your dreams. There's just one thing to figure out. Everything. That's why Shopify's all-in-one commerce platform makes it easy to sell online, in person, and everywhere else. Sell on social media, source products with an app to get that first sale feeling. It's the only solution that gives you everything you need to sell everywhere you want. So when you're ready to bring your idea to life, power it up with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen.